This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
In April of 2010, a deadly explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico caused what has become known as the BP oil spill. The spill pumped millions of barrels of oil into the Gulf and started amazing amounts of litigation that have no end in sight. A consortium of universities in Gulf Coast states is working on what to do about the ecological state of the Gulf now and when the money from fines is finally collected.
You know, the fish, they don't know where the border is.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll get a report on the state of the Gulf and the litigation 4 years after the spill. We'll also hear about getting better grades through oysters, and no, we don't mean eating them. And we'll spend an academic minute with declining leatherback turtle populations. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The Gulf of Mexico University Research Collaborative has a pretty far-reaching mission to enhance Gulf of Mexico coastal marine science, oceanography, and related management programs through communications, education, research, and public outreach, to promote activities of educators, scientists, and agencies responding to state, regional, national, and international issues, and to advocate for Gulf science and education with policymakers. As the name suggests, the collaborative unites over 75 public and private universities doing marine-related research in each of the Gulf states. Over the past 4 years, the collaborative has been working on the damage and restoration efforts in the Gulf regarding the BP oil spill. Last week, several oil spill-related events took place. First, Florida Senator Bill Nelson called a meeting of state and local officials of states and counties affected by the oil spill to give them a progress report on when some of the money collected in fines from the spill will be available. He said at the meeting that even though no money has been collected from BP yet, there are some funds ready for distribution.
One of the companies that was involved in this that has already settled is Transocean, and they were a subcontractor to BP in the actual operation of the well. And they have settled for, it's approximately $625 million. That fine has already been paid to the federal government.
However, before those funds can be distributed to the Gulf Coast communities affected by the spill, the government must first make regulations according to the law.
And the law was the one that Mary Landrieu from Louisiana and I passed 2 years ago called the Restore Act. And it has a very defined set of criteria which we had to negotiate with the other Gulf Coast senators. And that money is ready to flow as soon as the Treasury Department and the Office of Management and Budget issues their regulations.
And it looks like those regulations are ready to be announced.
They are trying to get those regulations out by Friday. And if it's not Friday, it will be no later than next Wednesday.
And that means the funds from Transocean can be distributed even though the trial to determine BP's culpability is still going on. Senator Nelson also said that in the long run, BP's liability could be anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000 per barrel of oil spilled.
You multiply that times 5 million barrels, well, you can see that you're talking anywhere from $5 billion to $25 billion.
But the senator also pointed out there's still a long way to go before that particular pot of money will be available to the Gulf Coast states affected by the spill. Which brings us back to the Gulf of Mexico University Research Collaborative. Andrew Shepard, the director of, well, let's call it GOMERC for now, addressed a meeting of county commissioners from each county in the state of Florida that borders the Gulf of Mexico. We spoke after his presentation, and I asked what he told the group.
What I was trying to get across was, number one, is that oil and gas activities are going to continue in the Gulf. They're going to continue to be deep, and they're going to continue to push towards the east, the Florida coastline, if they had the chance, because the resources are there. Secondly, that where are we at in terms of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill? What's the condition of things? What are areas of concern that we should continue to watch in terms of biology and the impacts of the oil spill? And then the last thing was to make some recommendations on areas that we think we need to continue to focus on, things like coordinating across all these restoration programs and pulling their information together.
I heard you mention, and then this struck a chord with me. There are so many different states you have to deal with this disaster. I mean, just in Florida alone, you have so many different counties to talk to. How difficult is it to just put all these efforts together?
Well, it's almost, I would say, it's close to impossible to do it without recognizing that they all have very different agendas and different missions, okay? So just suffice to say that you're never going to make them all see things the same way. That's never going to happen. What you need to do, though, is get their resources moving in the same direction. So each of these states and each of these counties is going to receive a some kind of penalty compensation from the oil spill. Some of the programs are going to be directed through federal programs. Some of them are going to be through the states. These states have done a very good job, some better than others. As we heard in the meeting today, Louisiana, for example, already has a master plan that it's pointing to direct its programs and where it goes. Some of them are, like Florida, are waiting on the regulations from Treasury for the Restore Act, which is where their money will come from. So the first step is going to be to see everybody's plans and what they propose to do. And if we can all see the plans and find out where the overlaps are, find out where the gaps are, I think that'd be a huge step in making it all possible. It doesn't mean that you'll ever get everybody saying the same thing about, we have to fix that, or this is bad, or this is good. They're all going to have different opinions. They're all going to want to do different things with their money. Some of them, like Louisiana, are required by law to repair barrier islands and do water, diversion projects and things that are a little bit different than, say, what so far we're seeing in Florida, where you're seeing a whole slew of things, everything fixing wetlands to building new infrastructure on the beaches so that you can draw more visitors and more tourists. So there's a real range across the Gulf, and I don't think we propose that you change that. You let these places do their thing. You let them improve the way that their citizens and the way their local economy will best benefit. What we hope, though, is that all of them see the value in a healthy ecosystem, in a healthy environment. And that has to be done the fish, they don't know where the border is. So we need to do that ecosystem repair together. And that's the challenge, and that's going to require a significant amount of investment in planning that so far hasn't happened. It has happened, like I said, in some programs, but others are just been waiting. So we need to move ahead, as Grover Robinson said from a congressional testimony that he did just last week. You know, that was the message. We need to move ahead with planning, and we can't do it until we get these regulations out the door so that we can receive the funding necessary to do this. So I think once we get that rolling and we get those plans out and we get them meshed and we have an infrastructure in place, I think it's possible. I think we can pull together and do this. Some people say it's impossible compared to, say, what happened in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez response, but I think we'll surprise people in the Gulf with the level of expertise and commitment to working together. And I think the Gulf Consortium is a good example of that. These are all these county commissioners spending their time to come and work together to try and make this sure this happens correctly.
We hear from Senator Nelson yesterday that those regulations could be less than a week away, right?
Right, so, right. We're hopeful. But remember, I think it was, they were mandated to come out in July of 2012. So we've been waiting a while now. And that's, that's painful because we do still, I saw some slides in there showing that things like the sea turtles and dolphins are still being harmed. We can't say, these populations are going downhill, all right? That's just suffice to say that these populations are being harmed. And the evidence is that got a lot worse after the spill. And we need to start to do things to turn that around. So, for example, for dolphins, that's a matter of increasing our activities and monitoring where they are and what kind of shape they're in. We're closing down dolphin stranding networks. We're closing down seabird programs, sea turtle programs. And that's because federal programs and state programs are in tight budget times. So instead of going in the direction we need to go in to watch what happens to these things and help them that get better, we're going in the wrong direction just because it's a difficult budget environment for these research programs. So we need to, maybe these programs give us the chance to reverse those trends and fix these valued environmental resources in a broader way than just saying, this ate a drop of oil, it's okay now. You know, we want to say, we want to improve that the populations of seabirds across the Gulf, of fish across the Gulf, the water quality across the Gulf. This is what we want this program to do. Much bigger challenge than an individual restoration project growing some new grass on a dune.
We're hearing about some of the money that are being that may be distributed soon because of the regulations Senator Nelson spoke about was from Transocean. We still don't really know how much we're going to end up getting from BP, though, do we?
No. The trial starts, recommences in January of 2015. So I think we're all hopeful that, at least in terms, except for BP, we're all hopeful that it will tend towards the middle range. You know, it's a range of like $5 billion possible to $20 billion possible, which would result in 80% of that, 80% of those, whatever that number is, going into the Gulf Restoration Trust Fund, which is part of the Restore Act. So we're hopeful that it tends to be at least towards the middle of that range. But it depends on the way the judge sees it. The judge in Louisiana, Judge Barbier, has been great so far in doing his due diligence and pursuing the right questions about penalties and negligence and the rate of the oil spill and all the things that go into calculating what BP's responsibility will be for the civil penalties. But that's the majority of the funding. The other big chunk is NERDA, the Natural Resource Damage Assessment. That trial may not happen until 2017. So, and that could be a big penalty assessment as well, in terms of they calculate things based on what they call contingency values, which means is we damage this much, we have to replace it. So they're in the process of going through all the natural resources that were potentially damaged by the Deepwater Horizon, actually damaged or potentially damaged, based on the science that they have. And that trial won't happen until 2017. So between the two of them, I think there's money there. We just need to get it going.
It's been 4 years since the spill. It's probably not on the top of very many people's minds anymore. Is it important to have these types of meetings just to keep it on people's minds and keep the pressure coming?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the process of doing science that's can be peer-reviewed and put into publication, the time you start taking trying to submit a proposal to get a project done to the time that the paper comes out is 4 or 5 years. I mean, a graduate student is anywhere from 2 years in a master's program to 6 years for a PhD. So that's not an unusual time frame to see a project launched, done, and then reported on, and peer-reviewed and reported on. So it takes some time to do those, come up with those answers. So I'm not surprised that we're having to take this time to do it. And I think this is going to be a 30-year assessment. And some of the programs like the National Academy of Sciences funded for 30 years to actually continue their work for 30 years. Remember, what we want is the Gulf to be better. We don't want to just make sure there's no more oil mat around the Mississippi Canyon site. We want to make sure that the Gulf ecosystem is better so that when it happens next time, it's stronger, it's healthier, it's more resilient to the next thing that happens.
Andrew Shepherd is director of the Gulf of Mexico University Research Collaborative. Still to come, a middle school in Maine has a unique program to help failing students. It involves oysters. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1247. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Joey Miller and Devon Gross were failing out of middle school. They were lucky to be in Regional School Unit 13. The district has a unique relationship with a local nonprofit. The Herring Gut Learning Center takes Joey, Devon, and their classmates for almost half the school week at no cost to the district. At Herring Gut in Maine, the students run their own aquaculture business. Now both students have a renewed attitude towards school and their future. Salt Radio's Jack Rodolico reports.
Devin Gross says he just didn't care about school.
I literally didn't do anything. I didn't do homework. I was always giving attitudes. I was missing school. A teacher would give me a detention or something for not doing homework, and I'd just like fight back and cuss and stuff like that. Bad choices.
He was on thin ice outside of middle school, too. Devin was placed on house arrest after, as he says it, he lit a fire to keep warm. He happened to be on the roof of a department store at the time. Joey Miller is Devin's classmate. Joey says he was failing all but two of his classes.
The only work I did do was for the teachers that I liked, which wasn't many. I guess you could say I was a class clown before I came here.
Here is the Herring Gut Learning Center in Port Clyde, Maine. At Herring Gut, Joey, Devin, and four classmates run a small aquaculture business. They raise baby oysters. Joey's the co-op president and Devin's the manager of the algae lab. They actually grow the microscopic algae they feed to the microscopic oysters.
I just got done soap washing all the flasks to get ready for acid washing. Soap washing gets all the leftover algae in and out, and acid washing pretty much kills the soap. And then we put them in the autoclave, which kills every bacteria and everything living on the flask.
Even though these are public school students, Herring Gut provides its own teachers. Ann Boover oversees the oyster business.
It's a different way of learning because it's hours out of a classroom. So I think for them, it's partly that they do get out of that traditional setting and they do get into this whole other universe, which is down here near the water doing something totally different and unique and fun.
But running a business isn't always fun, like in early March when all the oysters died. Joey recalls how many lives were at stake.
Probably somewhere around 9 million.
You ever think about that?
Sometimes.
What do you think about when you think about that?
That we're holding 9 million life forms, and we don't want to mess it up.
Not even the teachers are certain why the oysters died, but everyone has one guess. Here's Devin.
We got a protozoa problem. It's in the algae, and when we feed it to the oysters, that's what killed our last larva, oysters.
Even without a crop of oysters, there's a lot of work to be done. As the company president, Joey's in charge of making sure it all happens.
There's a lot of stuff that we do. We clean K-tubes, which are in the oyster, in the algae lab, with to hold our algae. We clean our filter, which is...
The kids know how to run the lab, but efficiency is another matter. They tend to flounder around before they get a handle on how to tackle the day's tasks. While these students are here for science, Herring Gut also pushes self-sufficiency. So today, Anne refuses to answer her students' questions.
Probably because we ask her too many questions, and she'd rather that me and Justice answered the questions from now on.
Do you think you're capable of answering every question?
Oh, yeah. I'm a very confident person.
While Anne is trying to teach her students how to run a business, she acknowledges it's not really about making money.
They are not fitting in with your traditional classroom. For whatever reason, however they got here, they have to be in this program, and in this program, they need to be boosted. They need to have their confidence built, and I can be empathetic because this student has been let to slide by in other circumstances, but he can't slide by here. It's not going to be okay.
These students are here because District 13 gave them a choice. Stay in the classroom where you're struggling or go to the alternative education classroom in St. George's School. That classroom has fewer students and more teachers than most, and it's where Devin and Joey spend most of their week. They both say it's that classroom that really changed their lives. Here's Joey.
I have a feeling if I didn't come down here, I probably would have dropped out of school when I had the chance. I have family members that have dropped out of high school and they're living with their parents without a job.
Herring Gut is one component of the alternative ed program, But it's a big component. The kids spend almost half their week here. And amazingly, Haringa covers over 90% of the costs. And the whole thing seems to work for the kids. Devin, who was arrested for arson, is now on the honor roll. But the real test will come next year when he goes to high school and has less individualized attention. The district has supports in place for him, but Devin knows the buck stops with him.
I'm going to try my hardest because right now I still try hard, but I don't need to try as hard because I have people guiding me along the way. But next year I'm probably going to have to bump it up another level and try and stay on a task by myself.
So you have to hold yourself accountable.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that sounds harder.
Yeah, it is.
Back in the lab, Joey and his classmates have until the end of the school year to sell a batch of oysters. They have some adult oysters waiting in a pen for the occasion.
We have to get our water temperature up to 24 degrees Celsius. We start feeding them more and more, and the only way I can really describe it is by tricking them into thinking that it's spring.
After spawning, there's a combination of luck and hard work that goes into producing a market-worthy product. At some point, though, the kids will have to step back, cross their fingers, and watch the oysters grow. For Salt Radio, I'm Jack Rodolico.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus.
Since we've been talking about the sea this whole program, well, no point in changing things up now. The population of leatherback turtles in the wild is declining at an alarming rate. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Leatherback sea turtles have been endangered for decades, and their numbers continue to decline. John Rowe, assistant professor of biology at the University of North Carolina, Pembroke, explains efforts to minimize encounters between leatherbacks and commercial fishing nets.
The leatherback sea turtle is among the largest species of living reptiles. Unfortunately, the Pacific population has declined by more than 90% since the 1980s. Conservation efforts for this endangered species have concentrated on protecting nesting beaches, but threats also occur at sea from accidental hooking or entanglement in fishing gear called bycatch. Fisheries targeting swordfish and tuna set more than 700 million hooks in the Pacific Ocean each year, which can add up to unsustainable mortality from injury or drowning for turtle populations already so close to extinction. Bycatch is undesirable for fishermen and conservationists alike, but information that could help avoid such interactions has long remained elusive. New data from 135 leatherbacks tracked via satellite has revealed a rare broad-scale perspective on times and locations where turtles aggregate to forage and pathways traveled during migration. When merged with data on fishing activities, times and areas of heightened bycatch risk have now been identified, reducing our largest ocean into a more manageable set of target hotspots. Specific regions highlighted in our analysis included seas of the Indo-Pacific Islands, near nesting beaches of Papua New Guinea, largely confined to political boundaries of nations that could facilitate bycatch management. Other probable hotspots occur far offshore, including in the South Pacific Gyre, a large rotating current southwest of the Galapagos. Such offshore regions may prove especially problematic, as they lie outside of national jurisdiction, where regulations are few and enforcement is nil. Strategies to avoid bycatch must be creative and tailored to the opportunities and challenges of each situation, but could include the establishment of marine protected areas or seasonal restrictions on fishing activities and methods. However, we now have a much clearer picture of where to focus such conservation efforts.
That was John Rowe of the University of North Carolina, Pembroke.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.